Blog Talk Radio.
bless you tonight. This is Co-host Ancestors. Don't let the devil lie.
In Atlanta, Georgia. He was the second son of Martin Luther King Sr. and Alberta Williams King. His parents divorced in 1931, and his mother became a Baptist minister. King attended Episcopal Church and Albany High School in Albany, Georgia. When 18, he enrolled in Morehouse College, a male-only institution established in Atlanta to train ministers and educators. In 1949, he completed his studies with a bachelor's degree. He earned a doctorate in sociology and economics, a master's degree in theology from Crowther Theological Seminar in 1951, and a doctorate in philosophy from his college in Boston in 1955. After graduating from Crowther's College, King moved to Ebenezer in Atlanta. He became a Baptist minister and served on the board of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, BERMINHAM campaign. The Montgomery bus boycott is a civil rights movement that took place in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955. The boycott was initiated by the Montgomery Improvement Society, organized by Martin Luther King Jr., and lasted for over a year. Rosa Parks, an African-American woman who refused to give up her seat for a white passenger on a segregated bus, was arrested. The boycott is considered one of the most important events that led to the desegregation of public buses in Montgomery and helped start the civil rights movement in America. The boycott supported him, Dr. King, and other civil rights activists and helped rally support for their cause. Opposition and assassination attempts. Martin Luther King Jr., January 15, 1929 to April 4, 1968, was an American clergyman, activist, and prominent leader of the African-American civil rights movement. He is best known for promoting civil rights through nonviolent civil disobedience based on Christian beliefs, inspired by Mahatma, his Gandhi's nonviolent activism. He was a civil rights activist early in his career. He led his bus boycott in Montgomery in 1955 and served as the first president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, in 1957. A year later, he helped found the Voter Education Project, VEP. This project addressed voter registration for African Americans. King's efforts led to the 1963 March on Washington, where he delivered his famous "I Have a Dream" speech. That speech became a pivotal moment in the movement to finally bring attention to the ongoing issue of racism in America and won the Nobel Peace Prize Award. He recommitted to ending poverty and ending the Vietnam War until his death in 1968. He also began to move away from nonviolence to what he called active nonviolence. King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4, 1968. The Presidential Medal of Freedom and the Congressional Gold Medal was posthumously awarded to him. Martin Luther King Jr. Day has also been a public holiday in many cities and states since 1971 and a federal holiday in the United States since 1986. Birmingham Campaign. The Birmingham Campaign was a strategic effort by civil rights activists to bring attention to the unequal treatment of African Americans in Birmingham, Alabama, led by Martin Luther King Jr. The campaign used nonviolent tactics such as marches, sit-ins, and boycotts to protest segregation and discrimination. The campaign began in April 1963 and lasted until June of that year. It resulted in the desegregation of many public facilities in Birmingham and helped to propel the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The Birmingham campaign is considered one of the most successful campaigns of the civil rights movement and stands as a testament to the power of peaceful protest. Nobel Peace Prize and last month. Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Peace Prize Award in 1964 for his work in the civil rights movement. In the final months of his life, King continued to speak out against the Vietnam War, poverty and racism, for justice and equality. He mobilized groups of people to create a united front against injustice. In April 1968, he was murdered while standing on the balcony of a Memphis hotel. His death sparked civil unrest across the United States while mourning the death of this great leader. To this day, the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. inspires people around the world to fight for justice and equality. His Nobel Peace Prize is a testament to his commitment to making the world a better place for all. Legacy. Martin Luther King Jr. was a civil rights activist who campaigned for racial equality in the United States in the 1950s and 1960s. His legacy is one of courage and leadership, powerful public speaking, dedication to nonviolent protest, and an unwavering belief that all people should be treated equally, regardless of race or origin. His story and his work helped shape the civil rights movement, which ultimately led to the end of racism in the United States and other countries around the world. He is also an advocate for economic justice and worked to improve the lives of those living in poverty. He is an influential figure in American history with a legacy that inspires people. Martin Luther King's Day. Martin Luther King's Day is a federal holiday that is celebrated in the United States on the third Monday of January. It commemorates the life and legacy of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated on April 4, 1968. The day is marked by events and activities to honor his memory and work, including parades, marches, speeches, and other celebrations. The holiday was first observed in 1986 and is now recognized in all 50 states. It is an important day for reflecting on the progress we have made in achieving racial equality and justice, as well as recognizing how much more work needs to be done.
King, that's what happened with Dr. Martin Luther King, and that's one of the stuff that I want to bring out tonight. We still got a lot of work to be done in the civil rights movement. But I want to say to you tonight, as we get ready to open up the Word of God, and I want to open up the Word to you, I want to tell you that you got to endure for God to bless you. This is Crossing with the Ancestors tonight. Those that need to cross over with the ancestors, I want to say to you, we're on from 11, we're on from 9 to 10, or from 10 to 11. And I think that's different in Detroit and other parts of the city. It would have a telephone call. But I wanted to share that with you tonight. The Word of God and the power of the Word of God. God bless you. I'm praying for your wife, that may have done in the hospital. No sorrow. Where can I heal? We're getting ready for that.
Oh. pay adoration to God. But among them are some Satan and thank God that because those things may be among the church, his presence never go unobserved by God. But not another thing about this, it seems that there is no society of people where Satan is completely absent. We like to say that Satan goes to fatherhood sometimes. Satan speaks with a different sometimes. Satan moves into us before people. Satan. Meaning all of the generous, human of the righteous, head of the gospel. But God always observes his presence. Hence the question, when we shall come up now, Satan? And Satan said, well, just from to and fro, up and down through the earth. Satan did not suggest that he had been visiting any particular community, but he has visited the satanic influence and satanic effect on all of these communities. There are those who would like to make us feel that Satan is just a Satan community. And some folks want to make us think that Satan is only in Paradise Valley, or that Satan is only on Hastings Street. But we have found that Satan is in any community. Satan is on all of the boulevards. Satan is on all of the fashionable communities. Wherever the wind lives, and Satan is there. Wherever the wind was hot, we have to guard against and watch out for evil in us. Listen, if you please. The Lord has asked you to Satan, have you considered the servant Job? Satan said in effect, yes, I know Job. Just as I know all the rest of you, I know Job. Have you considered that he said the Lord, that he still God? Satan implies that the only reason why that Job feared God and comes from the world back, God was driving Job. Satan, that you have a head of blessing around you. You have surrounded him with security. And anybody fear you and serve you. That was the implication of Satan. But the Lord knew that Satan was a son of love. And that Satan was conniving to discredit the godliness and the righteousness of Job. By saying that he was only good because he thought that the good fortunes of life that had been extended to him came from God. And had it not been for all of God's blessings, Job would not be what he was. The Lord said, well, now, you feel that way? Why, Job? Job was visited. He stopped. Job was out there from around. And give you the opportunity to test. I want to one exception. No father is so. But you see, Satan cannot violate the soul. Because the soul is a little part of God. So Satan went out from the presence of God to test. And God, he noticed you. And God told him power to was not shaken aloof from God. When Satan returned, the Lord said, well, now, what is your answer now? What is your position now? How about Job now? But you see now, people who are not shaken in that they do not wish to give anybody credit, no matter how good they are. People always find some excuse to discredit the good that you do. But Satan said, well, I don't know, he didn't fumble beneath the impact that was lost against him economically or rather physically. But a man loves himself. Let me climb economically. Let me attack him from the standpoint of his position.
Away at one time.
Righteous judge will give me testimony. these young Hebrew men who are former citizens of Judea. But Judea had been ruled by Babylon, and to these, along with many others of the Hebrews, had been taken to Babylon as prisoners of war. It seems that these young men and most of the Hebrews who were taken to Babylon had found adjustment in an otherwise unpleasant situation. Adjustment, you say? Why? Well, Babylon presented to the Hebrew mind and way of seeing things quite a challenge, because Babylon was paganistic. The Babylonians were worshipful of idols. They participated in the practice of idolatry. The Hebrews gave the world the one God idea, the spirit God idea. People who have enunciated such thinking must have found it uncomfortable and unpleasant in a paganistic environment. And when they found a judgment, as a Christian should find a judgment in this world, to be in it but not us. You see. Now, they did not isolate themselves, however. They participated in the general welfare of the community. And these young men, in particular, participated in the political government of the city of Babylon. Unfortunately, there has been derogatory thinking on the part of many Christians that Christians should divorce themselves from political interests. That has been completely unfortunate, because that kind of thinking renders some people disinterested in registering as citizens. So that over half of the population sometimes are not registered citizens in the community. That kind of thinking makes us indifferent to the people who control the police department. Make us indifferent as to those who make up the total administration. And the church should be concerned about food currency. The church should be concerned about who regulates and who formulates plans for taxes, who sees after the streets, and who sees after the lights, and who see after jobs, and who see after pensions, and who see after charity. The church ought to be concerned about that. Pray with me if you please. Who's on the welfare department? They're going to be concerned about the kind of men who hold these essential and important jobs. It is wrong and ridiculous. But such people are saying you ought not to be concerned about politics. You don't necessarily have to be a politician, but you ought to be concerned about politics. Well, I said some time ago, there's nothing wrong with politics. But politics is merely the science of government. There may be something wrong with a politician. You see what I mean? But there's nothing wrong with politics. And the church ought to be concerned about it. You who watch over you at night when you're sleeping. Who's gonna bring you jobs and what? You ought to be concerned about that. That is when you have so much religion that you don't be concerned yourself about that. I just had to spend a few minutes on that. You see, some Babylonians were concerned. And Babylon not only were they concerned, but they participated. They were all stood in influential positions in the Babylonian community. And their eyes were so fast, instigated, of course, because of their dedication to whatever they were doing. The native Babylonians became envious. These young men weren't playing. They were dedicated servants of God, number one. Number two, the position that they held in the city government, they were dedicated to that to do a good, a just, and a righteous job. But that the favor that they inspired toward them created in them, so many Babylonians conspired to get rid of. So they say, well, now, we've studied the background of these Hebrew folk. We know something about their theology. We know something about their religious culture. We know that they do not participate in idolatry and in the dedication and worship of other gods. And where? In their archives, somewhere in their sacred writings, they have something which says, thou shalt have no other God before me. I believe that if we can legislate and get included in the laws that govern the dedicatorial service, the dedication of a God out in the plains of the rock, today is coming. If we can get something put in them, but by his list, I believe we'll have these people. I believe we'll have. If we make it some culture, but put every citizen, every of the city will have to do. And if they do it, people have made them compromise their food. And if they don't do it, we will have them, because the law is, if you don't, will be thrown into a fire. I wish I had somebody here for him to be nice. And so, people can go into arguments and into protests, all these kind of things. They had to solve what their plan was. They were sure that position would be. They were the ones. They didn't play sick. They didn't hit the print. They went on outside. Oh, they could play sick. They could have come talk to the UU. But that too was in principle a compromise. That too would have hit their hands. They went on outside. And when the instruments began to play, and the announcement was made that every man was to pay their adoration and that tribute to the God that the king was dedicated. And even by God, they didn't bend over. All the reason that they brought out the vow, they stood up. They stood up. And I think that this attitude, this disposition that they took, should be a challenge to the people of God today. In the face of our fallen evil, in the face
Canvas Annuity makes life easier. Not only does Canvas offer high crediting rates for as little as 3 years on our straightforward annuity, but we also offer a simple online application process with much or as little help as you want. Research annuities in our online learning center or contact our knowledgeable non-commissioned agents if you have questions. Canvas offers fixed annuities that have crediting rates to protect you from market downturns, tax deferral which allows you to grow your retirement savings faster, and guaranteed income in retirement so you can retire with peace of mind. Save the simple way and watch your money grow, all from the comfort of your own home. Come see how easy it really is. Apply, fund, and sign online in minutes. Learn more at canvasannuity.com.
The disciples forsook him at the door. They did not lose him physically, but they did lose him from the standpoint of Israel. They went to sleep. They left him alone. As they did in
Visitor,
but no visitor.
The Old Testament contains all
none from it. But to see all of it was just schoolmaster. To bring us. I don't even know what it means tonight. They were just schoolmaster. To bring us. Hold us to his heart. In his heart shall love. Moses did his part in establishing the one God's idea, in establishing monotheism. Moses did his part in contributing in the world ethics and law. The laws that have lived from his time throughout the world. His contribution is great today in the world of Jewish food. No lawyer can ever forget Moses. No law-abiding citizen can ever forget Moses. Moses was on the mount. Elijah, when it comes to the ethics of Israelitic religion, even among those men who taught Israel, that God is not so concerned about your pigeons and your doves. What you ought to do is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly before your God. Be like that was on the mountain with Jesus. So my brothers and sisters, when Peter, John, and James woke up and saw company of this statue, visiting with Jesus in this mortal hour, they are on the mountain. He explained, let us build three tabernacles. Let's leave some landmarks here. Let's leave something here for prosperity. Let's leave something here that those who come in generations after will know what happened on this mountain. But when they were about to be carried away and perpetuated, Judaism. And they were about to be terrible and perpetuate possibly their prophecy as it stood and as it was in that day. The cloud of the Lord overshadowed these heavenly visitors that we lost from you. And out of that crowd they heard a voice. And that voice was, this is my beloved son. You've already heard. You've already heard. You lost. You heard. Jeremiah. You see this landing. You've heard all of it. You heard what the law had to say. And you heard what the prophets had to say. In one direction. That direction was towards Jesus. All room was towards Jesus. The men were getting something to him. And now, my law became the fulfillment of law and prophecy. The Lord is so high. The cloud rolled back. And yes, God has been out. And God has been out. And this is for sure. Oh, Lord. Thank you.
My main point here is that none of us should get into this dialogue of my slave master is better than your slave master, inasmuch as all of them were bad. But each one of us had to deal with a given situation. And all of the situations were bad. And all of the situations were humiliating. And none of the slave masters were kind. And none of them did us any favor. And none of them favored one over the other. And understand that the slave ship did not
have enemies. The answer is no. He said unto them, cast the net on the right side of the ship, and he shall see it. He shall come. They cast that world. Now they were not able to control by the multitude of fish. Therefore, our disciples in Jesus' blood said unto Peter, it is the Lord. The crucifixion was now in the background. That dreadful day, the most dreadful of all history, was now a thing of the past. The man called Jesus had been crucified, had been hung on a cross, had been buried in a borrowed tree. His disciples had become frightened and intimidated. And two by two, and possibly one by one, they were easing and sneaking out of town. The man who had inspired
My main point here is that none of us should get into this dialogue of my slave master is better than your slave master, inasmuch as all of them were bad. But each one of us had to deal with a given situation. And all of the situations were bad. And all of the situations were humiliating. And none of the slave masters were kind. And none of them did us any favor. And none of them favored one over the other. And understand that the slave ship did not bring any black Americans or any Caribbeans out of Africa. But only African people. And all of them had to become what the system made them become. And so we have to understand that all of us belong to a collective African family away from home. And subsequently, we are going to have to go back home or make some kind of contribution to Africans in Africa. All right, that's not my point. That's not the subject for tonight, but it is a subject that we cannot avoid. All right, now, why the emphasis on Africa and the rise of Christianity? And I'll tell you how I came to the subject briefly. Because I learned to read very early, because I wanted to teach Sunday school in a Baptist church, and because I had I was under the persuasion of a great lady, my great-grandmother, one of the great loves of my existence, because she was devoutly religious and a believer in the Bible to the point of saying everything in the Bible is true and not to be contradicted. And when I found all those white images and went to Grandma, Grandma said, "Shut up, boy. That's God's word." When I mentioned the curse and asked the question, what did we do as a people to get cursed? She rationalized it and said that, well, one day the veil will be lifted and we'll be freed of the curse. I could not deal with this because I had so much faith in her and her deep religious belief that everything in the Bible was true. I had not grown up, of course. I had not read books about how the Bible got written. I did not know at that time how to separate history from Jewish folklore. I did not know that principally the Bible is a Jewish survival book and a very good one, and that some of it is pure history, some of it is pure folklore, but all of it is spirituality. And we must understand, all of it was told as a spiritual story and for the spiritual enhancement of all men. I had not at that time looked at the Egyptian version and the Ethiopian version of the Bible. It was not until the late 30s that I saw an Ethiopian Bible. And in the Ethiopian Bible, there was only one white character, and that was the devil. I had not at that time been exposed to all of that, or the literature concerning the religions of the world. I saw that Africa was the basis of all the three major world religions. What I want to look at, I want to look at not only Africa as the basis of the world's religions, I want to look at the spirituality of the world of that day before the formal development of these religions. Because these religions were developed out of the spirituality that existed at the time. And that the spirituality at the time and the religions at the time was not a weekend thing. It was an all-conclusive thing that it embraced the life of its inheritance. To such an extent, your religion determined your dress, your marriage, your diet. It determined where you lived. It determined the totality of your life. And it was not a partial thing in your life. It was a total thing in your life, as your choice of spirituality supposed to be. Western man made it something that it was never intended to be. Now, my main point is that all of the elements that went into the making of the world's three major religions Christianity, I mean Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of the elements existed in Africa 3,000 years before the formal development of these religions. We want to look at these elements and look at these stories. Then we want to deal with the Hebrew interest and to what extent they copied African folklore and made this folklore a part of their history, and the same folklore having existed in Africa for thousands of years before they arrived. Now, what you have to look at also is the fact that we are talking about a period in the history of the world when there was no such thing as Europe. It's hard for you to believe this, and it is hard for you to understand that for most of the existence of the world, for most of the time, man has been functioning in the world, there was no such place as Europe. Now, we're looking at civilizations that existed before the creation of a place in northern Asia called Europe. That is not a colony. What you have to understand is the impact of the glacial age. And the glacial age hit Europe. For most of the existence of these early civilizations, Europe was an ice cap and was uninhabited. It was only after the melting of this ice that people could go into Europe and form a civilization or a way of life. And these first people were Africans. Now, you're wondering, how did they become white? Well, it's a longer story that we can tell. But nature endows man and woman with the covering they need when nature put them down. And nature subtracts from man and woman things that they do not need in the climate and in the environment when nature put them down or where they choose to dwell. All right, now, Christianity developed out of African humanistic values and social thought. These humanistic values and social thought was old in Africa and remained in Africa for thousands of years before someone gave the religion a name. In other words, there was probably more Christianity before someone decided that it should have a name, and they put a name on it. Now, this is reflected in a lot of literature, some written by our own writers, John Jackson's Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth, where he traces the concept of Christ in 26 civilizations, all 1,000 miles apart. In another work, Man, God, and Civilization, and another pamphlet, The African Origins of Christianity. And his new work, only out a few months ago, Christianity Before Christ. Now, the unfortunate thing about a book like Christianity Before Christ is that a lot of people will read the title, be intrigued with the title, and little afraid to read the book. And yet, he has treated the subject with great delicacy and with great respect. All he has done is to point out
that all of the elements that ultimately went into the making of Christianity existed in Africa before Christ, and someone came along and a set of circumstances made man formalize those elements and give it a name. Now that is not disrespectful of the religion at all. It is a tracing of the origins of the religion to African sources, Nile Valley sources, mainly Ethiopia and the nations in the Nile Valley. We're not emphasizing Egypt alone, because Egypt alone was not the producers of this great civilization. A complex of nations in the Nile Valley produced this civilization and produced the religion, the concept of worship, and the concept of a single God first appeared in Ethiopia. But the formalization of the concept would later appear in Egypt during the period of Akhenaten. All right, now, my point is that in looking at the religion, we have to look at the history at the same time. And we have to look at some of the literature around it, especially John Jackson's work, Ethiopia and the Origins of Civilization, and the pagan origins of the Christ myth, and other works, including the later work on the African origins of Christianity. All right. He shows also how this religion spread to India, spread to other parts of the world, and took on different names. And these deities appeared under other guises. All right, now, the formalization of these religions, of this religion, and this religion functioning side by side with other religions, brought no conflict at this time in history, none of the conflict that we see today. And we see it first taking shape in Ethiopia and moving down the Nile. In the fortunate circumstance of its birth and its development, before someone gave it a name, if there was no pressure or agitation about it in this setting. There was no Asian, there was no European, and the Africans wasn't fighting over it, and they granted each other the choice of choosing one aspect of it than another. But the Africans had already begun to develop the main aspect that would go into their spiritual life. An aspect that still goes into African spiritual life. If you visit the villages, you will not see it in the cities, but you will see it today in the villages. And that is bringing life in harmony with nature. And when we look at life today in the Western world is out of harmony with nature. It makes no sense. It makes no sense for one man to have enough bread to feed a multitude and to hold up the multitude. It makes no sense There's a lack of balance. When Africans had a society where each man gave and each man had according to his needs. Now this was a form of social living that predates the concept of socialism. This is what Karl Marx misunderstood, and this is what the Marxists still misunderstood, and this is what they stupidly call primitive communism. It wasn't primitive at all. It was advanced, and it was Christian. Because they say religion is the opiate of the people, they can't deal with the fact that these early societies in their spirituality was a total thing. And religion wasn't the opiate of the people. Religion was part of the totality of the society and part of the day-by-day spirituality of the society, and it determined everything. It was only in the emptiness of Europe. It was only under feudalism. It was only in the misuse of the church. It was only in this regard, the hustlerism of the European church, that they turned it into the opiate of the people. But religion was never intended to be the opiate of the people. And this is why the European has no understanding of the non-European mind, of the non-European spirituality.
Oh. All right, good.
These early religions were not hurriedly brought into being or hurriedly changed. They stayed intact for years. So the basic thing about these religions was to create balance. Balance in society. And a respect for the law of God. If you have a God, you have to have a God.
Yes.
Here you have the first female equality. Here you have the first female gods of history. While Hathor is the best known of the early gods, because her influence spread to India, and the concept of the sacred cow started from the worship of Hathor. But the greatest and the most influential of all of the female gods is Maya, who is still worshipped. Now, Europe never had a female spiritual figure. At no time did any female rise to a permanent position in the spirituality of Europe or Islam. I am saying that these Africans had created a society where the fear of the female mind was unknown, and where man was considered to be a balance or unbalanced without female companionship. And where sometimes the God was depicted as being a combination of male and female. Because the totality of man, as it is conceived, consisted of female. Now, this humanistic way of looking at life and looking at people brought into being a concept that is still practiced in Africa, and that is the concept of a matrilineal society. The concept of a society where the lineage comes down through the female side of the family. In most African societies to this day are matrilineal as against patrilineal. And every invader and the last of the massive invaders who tried to change this and succeed in changing it in one part of Africa, especially west, east coast, would be the Africans. Now we will talk about this when we talk about African rise of Islam. Then we will also deal with certain segments of the television series, The African, and certain basic glaring errors so smoothly told that you have a hard time accepting them as errors. Because the man that is narrating it is an absolute master. He has been at the game so long, and he is himself about. I mean, it's time that Africa waited in darkness for Islam to bring the light. And he's not the only one, because our word is reflected right here. He is not admitted that when Islam came, Egypt had been raped for 1,000 years. And it came to feed on the fallen body of a once great nation.
Yeah.
Of course they brought a new religion, and of course they brought some order in a language. But like all invaders, ultimately they did no harm to good. Now what you need to do is to look at Africa and look at the difference between history and folklore. Let's look at African spirituality in the years before any invader touched African soil. No invaders, no outsiders at all. We're looking at the elements created in Africa that ultimately is going to go into Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. These elements, spiritual elements, created by Africa, and finally the coming of invaders and what they did. Now, when people say that what they did in Africa, when someone said that they came to Africa and built the pyramids, the people who said they built the pyramids arrived in the 13th dynastic period. Most of the pyramids were built between the 3rd and the 6th dynastic period. They arrived over 1,000 years later. If they say they built bricks without straw, there is no record in African history that bricks were ever built that way. And there's no record where slave labor ever constructed anything as fine as what was constructed in Africa. Now, let's deal with Hebrew myth, a dangerous thing to deal with in and out of the church. All right, they came in the 1700 B.C. Inasmuch as so much of the Bible is involved with Hebrew myth, And so much of Christianity is involved with Hebrew myth, then let us deal with Hebrew myth. They came 1700 B.C., escaping famine. A bunch of hungry people, Western Asian gypsies, looking for a home. They brought no spirituality to Africa. They brought nothing of substance to Africa. They came and they ate. They got the bellies full. They got land. Some of them married African women, Abraham being one of them. Misused her, literally discarded her. In 1680, Africa was invaded by the Hyksos. What position did they take? Did they join their African friends against the first invaders of Africa? No. They joined the invaders. And they rose to high position under the foreign king. Now I'm not dealing with fiction now, I'm dealing with fact. I'm not dealing with folklore, I'm dealing with fact. They rose to high position under the foreign king. The Hyksos called the Shepherd King. This lasted 150 years, almost 200 years. They produced the world's first wheeler, dealer, politician named Joseph called the Provider. Why could he provide? Because he had the ear of the then remaining king. And he could provide for his people because politically he was entrenched. Then, as the Bible said, Joseph died, his relatives died, and a king emerged, arose, who knew not Joseph. Who is the king who knew not Joseph? Now we have to go to straight history. Who was the king during that period? Part of the period was Seti. But the period of the so-called Exodus, I'm using my words advisedly, the king was Ramesses II. Now there's no record of any pharaoh being drowned chasing any Jews across any water. Now how do I find out? I go on this side of the so-called water, and I study the literature of that day. I find no record. And I go on the other side and I find no record. No record of that many people departing. No record of that many people arriving. No record spirit. And yet I look at the Ramesses dynasty. It is one of the best recorded dynasties in history. Ramesses stumped his toe and made a record on it. Nefertaria, his favorite wife, the Nubian wife, thought so much of her, he built a tomb, built a temple for her, equal to his own, one of the most beautiful temples in the world and one of the finest temples ever erected in memory of a woman. She goes to visit her relatives in the Sudan, Kush, comes home, he makes a record of it. And yet, 100,000 people depart from this country and there's no record. What are we dealing with? Folklore? Or we're dealing with facts? There's nothing wrong with folklore, so long as you know what it is and can separate one thing from the other. Now, if some of you came from the South, we have a character called High John the Conqueror. Now, anytime we want something done that we don't have the nerve to do, we assign to High John the Conqueror. We start talking, man, did you see High John slap that white man's face and he ran like a jackrabbit? Lying like a dog, we know it. Everybody know it. It's folklore. John Henry is folklore. This famous steel diving man. I ran a train. Story told by John Henry. John Henry was one day old and woke up and people were all having a big feast and John asked him, why nobody fed him? Did the family eat? Yes, John, the family said, did you feed the dog? Yes. Am I as good as the dog? Then why don't somebody feed me? It's a total lie. John Henry is a figment of somebody's imagination, but at least we know that. All people tell stories to make themselves feel good, and there's nothing wrong with that, so long as you are clear about what you are doing. The Hebrews copied African stories to make themselves feel good and said, that was us. Then we come down and believe it. When the story of Joseph and Mary, and I've personally seen it, in the great Lodge of Luxor, was carved in stone, and the story existed 2,000 years before Abraham arrived. The story of Cain and Abel is an old African story, was an old African story before they got there. And there's a whole book of flood stories. Everybody, every culture has its flood story. Now, the Bible is not less, a Bible is not less holy because it is part fiction, part history, and part folklore. It is still a book of inspiration. It is still a book of spirituality. And you can separate one thing from the other and keep it. I didn't say throw it out. I say understand it. I think you can get more out of it by understanding it. And what I'm saying is that the Hebrews copied African folklore and integrated African folklore into the book, but they personified it, saying this happened to us, when in fact it didn't happen to them at all. They merely said it happened to them. All right, now, when they had to face the Pharaoh, who knew not Joseph, and when he said, those of you who wish to obey African law may stay. Those of you who do not wish to obey African law would have to go. Those are the ones who left Africa. Now that's the origin of it.